From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Bironk, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The heavy traffic caused by illegal immigration into the United States is causing some environmental concerns. NPR's Ted Robbins has a report on the degradation of the desert as illegal immigrants pass through. April is Alcohol Awareness Month. We'll hear the stories of three people who struggled with alcoholism at an early age. We'll tell you about a new exhibit at the Tucson Museum of Art, and Soo Young Lee has a feature story on the Tucson International Mariachi Conference. Those stories and more are coming up, but first. Some of America's most environmentally sensitive land lies along the U.S.-Mexico border, and those areas are being threatened by illegal immigrants and by the Border Patrol chasing after them. NPR's Ted Robbins reports.
The Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge is a rolling grassland and desert surrounded by mountains in southern Arizona. It was created to protect the creatures who make this home.
I've seen jackrabbits that stand as tall as the front of my truck. Hawks, a lot of hawks. I've seen a golden eagle. I've seen the pronghorn.
Jenny Neely began visiting the refuge a decade ago. Then she started volunteering. But now...
Now I'm afraid to even drive to the areas where we used to meet our volunteers by myself.
That's because this refuge for wildlife has become a highway for drug smugglers and economic refugees, and a staging area for the Border Patrol. On a bright, windy day, I hop in an SUV with Assistant Refuge Manager Sally Gall to see for myself. We drive south to a dirt road about 2 miles north of the Mexican border. Trails split off from the road on both sides. Not designated trails, paths created by repeated illegal crossings.
These areas here, not only is it an immigrant trail, but see where all the vegetation is. This is a pull-out spot for law enforcement. And mostly Border Patrol. Now, you know, this is happening all over the refuge.
We get out of the vehicle and climb over a barbed wire fence pushed down by crossers before us.
We are estimating a good 200,000 to 300,000 immigrants through this valley a year.
We're walking along a trail, which looks like it's certainly wide enough for a vehicle, and we're coming up along. Well, it kind of looks like, frankly, a trash dump. What is it?
Yeah, this is bad.
The ground is covered with rolls of toilet paper, water jugs, backpacks, and clothing left behind when smugglers ordered crossers into vehicles to make the trip north. Add to that SUVs, ATVs, and motorcycles the Border Patrol uses to pursue the crossers. That's why Jenny Neely went from a visitor and volunteer here to an activist for the environmental organization Defenders of Wildlife.
The enforcement measures that follow that traffic are at least as bad, if not worse, to the landscape.
She blames policies which for a decade have walled off access in urban areas and pushed people into areas like this. Almost 4,000 people have died crossing the desert, and there's been no drop-off in overall illegal immigration.
And so to say that we just have to pay the price and sacrifice some of the crown jewels of America's public land system for a policy that is questionable at best, to achieve what?
Environmentalists like Neely also say they fear the Real ID Act passed by Congress last year. That law allows the Department of Homeland Security to build border barriers without going through environmental review. David B. Miller is with the Border Patrol. He agrees there's been damage.
Well, there's certainly a huge impact on public lands as a result of the illegal alien activity, cross-border activity.
But B. Miller says it's not the Border Patrol's fault. He blames illegal immigrants and those who smuggle them. B. Miller is the public lands liaison for the Border Patrol's Tucson sector, which covers most of Arizona. He's been trained in environmental law, and he says the Border Patrol now has policies to minimize its impact.
It's not necessary for a Border Patrol agent to go off-road for any reason, with the exception of actually following foot sign or tire sign or any other illegal cross-border traffic.
So only in pursuit?
Only in pursuit, correct.
But the bottom line is, if you got to pursue, you pursue, right?
Correct.
I mean, wherever it is.
Correct.
It's such a beautiful area, and it still is.
Assistant Refuge Manager Sally Gall.
But, you know, it's sad in some ways, but also discouraging that we need to deal with this on a day-to-day basis.
The government continues to put more resources on the Arizona border to stop the flood of illegal immigrants. But critics say even if the effort here is successful, it will just push the problem elsewhere to other public lands. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, the stories of three people who struggled with alcoholism at an early age. That story when we continue with Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. April is Alcohol Awareness Month, and a state program that investigates underage drinking has been awarded a grant from the U.S. Department of Justice. The group works to trace where underage drinkers involved in car accidents got their alcohol. Organizers are hoping to reduce the number of teens killed in alcohol-related deaths. They say that number was 45 last year. According to research conducted by George Washington University Medical Center, it's estimated that over 67,000 young people ages 12 to 20 in Arizona have a serious problem with alcohol, and 84% will not seek treatment. Today, the stories of three people who struggled with alcoholism at an early age. Alcoholism is defined as a primary chronic disease with genetic, psychosocial, and environmental factors influencing its development and manifestation. Every day, thousands of people struggling with this disease gather in support groups, many of which are conducted by Alcoholics Anonymous, or AA.
My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Matt.
AA is a voluntary international fellowship founded in 1935. It's concerned with the recovery and continued sobriety of the alcoholic who turns to the organization for help. The program consists of 12 suggested steps designed for the personal recovery from alcoholism and is the major proponent of the disease model of alcoholism.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Acknowledgement of loss of control over alcohol and a willingness to seek help through a higher power are a major part of the organization's 12-step program. Recovery is sought through prayer and meditation to improve conscious contact with the higher power as each individual understands it.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
To some, the term alcoholic might evoke the image of the stereotypical town drunk, someone who's unable to hold a job and who has a dysfunctional family life. But alcohol dependency is not only an adult problem. It also affects a significant number of adolescents and young adults between the ages of 12 and 20, even though drinking under the age of 21 is illegal. It's been estimated that over 3 million teenagers are out-and-out alcoholics, and several million more have a serious drinking problem they cannot manage on their own.
I think a lot of people do see it as a phase because a lot of teenagers do drink. I had to realize my own truth. And there wasn't anything that anybody could recognize, or wasn't anything that anybody could do. Even if, you know, my parents realized it, there was nothing that they could do about it.
Cheyenne is 17 years old and attends a Tucson area high school. She's thin, bright-eyed, and has a vibrant and outgoing personality. Cheyenne's also a recovering alcoholic and has been sober since the age of 15.
My parents are both in AA and have been since before I was even born. We never had alcohol in the house or anything. At the age of 13 was when I started drinking. I thought that for some reason that would help me become cooler and stuff, because I wasn't so cool in middle school, and The popular kids wanted to drink with me because I didn't get in trouble a lot. And so my drinking kind of progressed and got worse. I would take one drink, like I would just have, you know, a beer or a shot, and then I would get all of a sudden this extreme thirst where, you know, I wanted to drink everything, and I was just like, oh, where's the next beer? Where's the next this? And, you know, and it was like I couldn't stop. There's nothing I could do because it's like, you know, like my body was like telling me, you're thirsty. You need all the alcohol you can get. And so it's like I couldn't drink like everybody else. You know, everyone else would be like, oh, I have like two beers. And they'd like get drunk off of that. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Kind of a wuss are you, you know, because it's like I didn't realize that the reason why I could, you know, overdrink people was because of the fact that I drank so much all the time.
For Cheyenne, there's nothing anybody could have done. She had to realize for herself that she was an alcoholic and then seek treatment before her addiction ruined her future.
The reason why I stopped drinking pretty much was I ended up feeling extremely worthless and just not really appreciating myself. And my mom had always taught me, you know, you need to appreciate yourself, appreciate who you are, and you're a beautiful person no matter what anybody says. And I had lost that somewhere along the way, and nothing really mattered anymore. I had pretty much lost like all my friends from my childhood and everything like that. And I was just like, I need to stop. I realized that if I went on any further, I saw where my life would go. I saw that, you know, I'd end up in jail. I'd end up dying, essentially, from it.
I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Like Cheyenne, alcoholism runs in Sarah's family. Her father had a problem with alcohol, but had stopped drinking when she was a small child. Sarah first got drunk at 13 and sober at 21. She says the first time she got drunk, everything was great. She was hanging out with a new group of friends, and everything was going her way.
The guy that I was supposed to meet that night liked me. I was funny. Everything I wanted to be that I felt like I couldn't be kind of came true to me in my perception that night when I got drunk. And it wasn't a daily drinker by any means. It was more of a drinker and other drugs when the opportunity approached. But my whole thought process, my priorities in life became hanging out with my friends, getting drunk and high whenever possible. It wasn't school, it wasn't my dance, it wasn't my singing, it wasn't my family relationships at all. I learned how to get into the bars at 17, and I really enjoyed that. So the other stuff was if it was around or if I wanted to try something new. I enjoyed mixing alcohol and cocaine together because it helped me stay awake longer and drink more.
Unlike Sarah and Cheyenne, who came from what could be described as normal families, Eddie did not have a good home life and spent most of his adolescent years in the system. He was raised in a very abusive home. By the age of 14, he was drinking every day.
Long story short, I was raised in a very alcoholic household. My mom was 16, my dad was 30 when they got married. A lot of abuse. Alcoholism is pretty rampant in my family. A lot of death, a lot of verbal, physical abuse. I ended up running away when I was 14, already very much into my alcoholism, drinking every day. And moved around a lot, from San Francisco, Denver to New York. Got involved in a lot of crime. Chop shop, gun robbery, assault, forgery, been raided twice. Outside of this last sentence, I was 21. And they sentenced me to AA as part of my I guess restructuring or getting back on track. And I felt right at home. I identified, and for the first time in my life, I kind of realized who and what I was. I was institutionalized a few times, and this last time I jumped through hoops to kind of look good for the judge. And because so many of my charges were drug/alcohol related, when I got out this last time, they strongly suggested I'm not sure if it's genetic, but I know I have alcoholism. So the way I understand it is, it doesn't matter if I grew up in a Cleaver family, if I was sheltered or just whatever, because alcoholism was going to do to me what it was supposed to do to me anyway. So once I started drinking, I had that phenomena. I just craved more. So regardless if I grew up in a very structured household or very, you know, neglectful, I think I was destined for it.
Now 29, Eddie has been sober since the age of 21. He's completely turned his life around and he works in marketing and sales. Cheyenne, Sarah, and Eddie are all in recovery, and they work every day to maintain their sobriety. They attend AA meetings at least 3 times a week and help other alcoholics stay sober. To find out more information about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can visit their website at www.alcoholics-anonymous.org. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. When we continue, KUAT Soo Young Lee has a feature story on the Tucson International Mariachi Conference. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Every April, thousands of people gather to celebrate one of the largest cultural events in the United States, the Tucson International Mariachi Conference. Producer Soo Young Lee has more.
Over the next few days, students and musicians around the nation converge for a week-long celebration of mariachi music and culture. It's the 24th annual Tucson International Mariachi Conference.
We call it a conference because it includes an educational component.
Dr. Celestino Fernandez of the University of Arizona Sociology Department teaches and writes about Mexican music. He says the first conference, which had 9,000 in attendance, started as a fundraiser.
It's always been associated with La Frontera, which is the largest behavioral health agency in southern Arizona. And our purpose is to raise funds for La Frontera, particularly for the Child Family Center.
Originating in Mexico, mariachi music thrives in Tucson. There are over 2 dozen mariachi bands in Tucson alone.
Tradition was brought, obviously, by Mexican immigrants and people who lived the Southwest becoming part of the United States prior to 1848. And so the music was well known by Mexican-Americans. And really about 25 or so years ago, it started to become much more popular in the United States, not only with Mexican Americans, but with a general population. So that some of the participants in our workshops, for example, are African American students, Asian students, Anglo students, white students, and certainly the majority Mexican American students.
Traditional mariachi uses string instruments such as the guitar, violin, folk harp, large bass guitar called guitarrón, and a round back guitar called vihuela, and of course, trumpet.
There are basically two types of songs associated with mariachi tradition. One is dance music, the son, El Son de la Negra, for example, a very popular one. And the other one is what's called ranchera, música ranchera, sort of Mexico's country western music, if you will, and which is very passionate, love music, and also I think this whole style. of the formality of this attire that mariachis wear, the way they stand. If you ever watch mariachis never play sitting down. Mariachis always stand, and they stand tall. The role of women in this tradition, in this mariachi tradition, really almost is a U.S. innovation. Yes, there used to be some mariachis in Mexico that included women, or all female mariachis, but those were rare, exceptions to the rule. In the United States, from about the 1970s to the present, we see a lot of mariachis that include both men and women, and we also have a number of all-female mariachis.
Dr. Fernandez says the conference is a celebration of culture for everyone.
The average individual enjoys the music and the performance of that music, which I mentioned, you know, there's a sense of passion in both the performance and the delivery of many of these songs. But the entire history, you know, the average person may not see is the entire history associated. Why do they dress the way they do? Why these particular instruments? And I just really enjoy to see what happens with the young people as they enter this tradition, and they too take great pride and stand tall and are able to share with others, not only in the United States, but literally throughout the world.
Arizona Spotlight, I'm Suyan Lee.
The Tucson International Mariachi Conference runs through this Saturday. For more information, call 838-3908 or log on to tucsonmariachi.org. Up next on Arizona Spotlight, curator Stephen Vollmer talks about a new exhibit currently on display at the Tucson Museum of Art. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The Tucson Museum of Art is vacant on Mondays. It's the one day of the week that they're closed. But I've been invited inside to take a look at a new exhibit. At the Tucson Museum of Art, the walls are hardly bare. Art pieces and sculptures from various areas are on display. In a small room painted a deep yellow, bright, vivid colors of tissue paper hang from the ceiling and walls. Bright greens, blues, reds, all bearing various images intricately cut out of the thin paper. It's called Papel Picado, and it's on display at the museum until June 30th. Papel Picado is the exquisite art of cut paper and is one of the most memorable but ephemeral expressions of Mexican popular art. Museum organizers have been working on the exhibit for the last year and a half. It's displayed in the Palace Pavilion, a space dedicated to the traditions of Latin America and inclusive of folk art. The doily-like pieces come from the small town of Huixcalotla near the city of Puebla, Mexico. Stephen Vollmer is curator of Art of the Americas at the museum. He says from Huixcalotla the tradition has been traced back at least 200 years.
The tradition, however, probably originates from China, arriving to Mexico in the 16th century. Late 16th century, when the trade between Asia and Europe, in the case of the Habsburg Empire, which Mexico was a part of, all of it went through Mexico before going on to Europe.
The artisans who create this type of art are celebrated for their technical abilities to shape these cutouts. The designs are complex and are executed by using several chisels with straight edge, circles, and curves of varying degrees.
Traditionally, a lot of these drawings are these cuts are going to be made in a series of 50, and what it is, the artisans will take variegated colors of tissue paper and they will separate, oh, maybe 50 sheets. And when they cut the top piece, they are using very sharp chisels and they're cutting through the paper. So you get 50 images of the same theme.
Once the design is complete, papel picado is traditionally suspended across streets, pathways, patios, and ceilings during festive periods. This type of art is an integral component within the ceremonial life of Mexico.
Imagine this, that where there's a little bit of wind or a little bit of air movement, that paper is moving back and forth, and in some ways, too, it also creates a little bit of a shadow. So during the day, there's also that very slight rustling of the noise. So it attacks all of the senses. Visually, it has a theme, but we also hear it. And then over time, if it's left outside, which was often done, the material slowly begins to disintegrate.
Artisans use brilliant or somber colors of paper to indicate the nature of the event. One of the pieces, cut out in vivid blue paper, has the image of a skeleton as a baker, preparing bread for the Day of the Dead. The piece hanging to the right of it also bears the image of the skeleton. It's riding a bicycle, carrying a basket of the bread on its head.
The bicycle in this case is a reinterpretation of the old cart, the death cart, that we would often associate with some of the penitente sculpture from New Mexico. But it all goes back to the plague art of the 16th or 15th century in Europe, reinterpreted in the 19th and 20th century. The bicycle shows the mechanization or the Industrial Revolution. It was done nearly 100 years ago now by José Guadalupe Posada.
Because papel picado fades over time and ultimately disintegrates before our eyes, the art is often underappreciated. Vollmer says it's a reminder of the passage of time and the journey of life.
It's also a reminder that the soul is everlasting within the traditional belief systems of Latin America and many parts of the world. But there's this wonderful old Mexican adage that says, don't take life too seriously. No one gets out of it alive.
The Papel Picado exhibit will be on display at the Tucson Museum of Art through June 30th. For more information, call 624-2333 or visit the museum website at tucsonarts.com. And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
Tonight and tomorrow night at Club Congress downtown, the Monologue Cabin returns. Your chance to hear local writer-performers share their views and humor on life. It's at 7 o'clock. HotelCongress.com has information. Going on this Sunday, Charanga La Unica will provide the Latin sounds for the Some Like It Hotter Salsa Dance Contest. That's at St. Philip's Plaza Sunday evening, presented by the Tucson Jazz Society. This is the last weekend to catch the Pima County Fair this year. SWFair.com has information. This Monday, the UA School of Music presents the annual Chamber Music Showcase at Crowder Hall, featuring UA School of Music students performing duos, trios, quartets, and quintets. KUAT radio announcers David Harrington, Bill Pitts, and James Reel will be there for a pre-concert reception. For information, 621-2998.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.